Hi, podcast listeners. This week, to the best of our knowledge, is collaborating with The Conversation, an independent news and analysis site, to bring you talks with academic researchers that reframe events in the news. I'm Anne Strainchamps, and this week, it seemed like all anybody was talking about was that recording that surfaced of Donald Trump making some fairly disgusting remarks about women. He says,
"This was locker room talk. I'm not proud of it. I apologize to my family. I apologize to the American people. Certainly, I'm not proud of it. But this is locker room talk. You know, when we have a world where you have..."
Locker room talk. That's code, right? For a certain kind of macho sexual braggadocio, guys talking about women as a bunch of body parts. And what's implied is that inside a secret world of segregated man spaces, locker rooms, clubhouses, men's rooms, this is normal. It's just how guys talk. Well, a whole bunch of NFL and NBA players this week have been tweeting that that's not how anybody talks in their locker rooms. So why do we think that's true? Maybe because that's the message we give boys and girls in places like sex ed classes.
There's one thing I find particularly problematic, which I often have heard repeated, is this sort of notion that boys and men think of sex every few seconds and they get taught this. So what if you don't? Like, what if you're a young boy and you don't do that? You think like, oh, I'm supposed to.
This is Amy Shallett. She's a sociologist at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, and she has done hundreds of interviews about teen sexuality with boys, parents, and sex ed teachers, both here in the U.S. and in other countries.
There's a real assumption in the U.S. of kind of a battle between the sexes where boys just want sex and girls just want love. What's even more surprising, though, is that when we look at what American boys actually want, they seem to be far more romantic than popular stereotypes, and they are far more interested in relationships and love than we assume, but they often think they're alone. They think that most boys are supposed to be these raging hormone machines, and maybe there's something wrong with them for not being like that.
Yeah, there's a statistic, something about when asked to choose between having a girlfriend and no sex, or sex but no girlfriend. Run through the statistic for me. I'm probably not saying it right.
No, you're saying it just right. So another way of putting it is that boys choose having a girlfriend and no sex over having sex and no girlfriend by 2 to 1.
That's a lot.
In other words, there's twice as many boys, about two-thirds of boys would prefer the girlfriend over sex. And I will tell you, not only you are stunned by that, but most boys reading that, or young men who I teach in my classes, are stunned by that.
Really? What did they say?
It's kind of like, oh my God, you know, I'm not alone. One of the reactions that I got from one of my students, he's like, no one talks to us about love. You know, if I had known this, that this is normal and that I'm normal, it would have changed my life. And in fact, one of the things that I found comparing the U.S. and the Netherlands in terms of understandings of teenage sexuality is that Dutch parents and sex educators assume that both genders actually want and can be in love.
You know, there is just something so heartbreaking about this because
I know.
I think any parent, certainly any mother like me of, you know, even the most macho teenage boy would tell you that, yeah, alongside the trash talking and the swagger, there's also a tender heart, an emotional sensitivity, desire for closeness. Are you saying that boys in other countries hide that less than boys do in the U.S.?
Yes. For instance, when I interview Dutch boys, I ask them about girls and boys being different. One boy said, well, you know, maybe within relationships, boys might want to have sex a little earlier than girls. But I think everyone wants to be close. Everyone wants to have that intimacy. And so that sense that they are like everyone really creates a very different story from what I heard among the American boys, which is, you know, I want to have a relationship, I want to be in love, but I think I'm an exception. Most boys are really different. And you know, as my research and much other research finds, that's, they're not the exception. but they're left thinking they are. And that creates sort of another layer where boys then feel like they have to perform a role that they're not even really feeling.
Yeah, which has something to do with the larger culture. I mean, I was so startled to read in the book you wrote on this subject that in the Netherlands, it's common for teen boys and girls to be allowed to have sleepovers together at a parent's house.
Absolutely.
And not uncommon for the parents to supply contraceptives.
Yeah, and generally speaking, in the Netherlands, the condition for permitting those sleepovers is a serious relationship. And that doesn't mean a relationship for life. They don't expect 16-year-olds to get married.
But it means more than a hookup.
It's more than a hookup. And one of the things that I think is very interesting about permitting teenagers to come into their sexuality in that way, under the parental roof, so to speak, is that it, especially for boys, gives them an opportunity to start practicing combining intimacy and sexuality, domesticity and romance, rather than splitting them. And one of the things that I think happens, in the U.S., is that by sort of pushing both conversations about sex and love and the actual experience outside of the home, parents are sometimes inadvertently, really not intending to, but reinforcing some of these gender stereotypes that harm both girls and boys.
I'm talking with sociologist Amy Shallett. So how did this idea get so entrenched in the U.S., that boys and girls, men and women, are so different? So earlier I mentioned Donald Trump's comments about locker room talk and this idea of gender-segregated spaces. Well, let's bring in Terry Kogan. He's a law professor at the University of Utah, and he's interested in the recent legal battles around gender-segregated public bathrooms. And when he looked into them, he discovered that the laws that established separate men's and women's restrooms grew out of a very specific set of dated assumptions about women.
Early in the 19th century, an ideology developed in the United States that is often referred to as the separate spheres ideology. There was a sense that the proper sphere, the proper place for women, was in the home, and the proper place for men was in public, in factories, basically taking care of public life. That ideology painted women as particularly virtuous and as particularly vulnerable. And therefore, there was a sense that once they went into the public, they needed to be protected.
I was so surprised to read in your article that although it seems natural to us right now to have separate men's and women's restrooms, in fact, the U.S. only started requiring that by law in the late 19th century.
The first law was adopted in roughly 1887 in Massachusetts, followed shortly by New York. And by 1920, roughly 40 states had adopted laws mandating that public restrooms be separated by sex.
Why not until then?
So not long after the beginning of the 19th century, the economics of manufacturing demanded that women leave homes and take jobs in the public realm. So you've got this terrific conflict between, on the one hand, a cultural vision that women should stay at home and the economic reality that women were populating factories and other workplaces. So by mid-century, states started enacting protective labor legislation to protect these women who had left their proper sphere, the home, to take jobs in factories.
What was the rationale at the time for women needing separate bathrooms?
The sex-separated restroom, in particular the women's restroom, was viewed as a kind of home-like haven, a surrogate for the home in the public realm, a place where vulnerable, weak women could be protected. And that was the origin of that space. There was nothing gender neutral, nothing benign about the separation of public restrooms into men's rooms and women's rooms.
So really it was not just about who gets to pee where. It was really about a lot more than elimination.
Absolutely. The other interesting phenomenon was you find regulators outside of factories beginning to create spaces that were women-exclusive spaces.
So not just bathrooms.
That's exactly right. In public libraries, spaces in which women had not even been allowed long before mid-19th century. They started constructing separate ladies' reading rooms. And these reading rooms, curiously enough, were decorated like a private home.
Hmm. Amy, I'm curious. This is not exactly what you study, but any reaction to the history Terry's described?
You know, it's clear from hearing you that a sort of explicit ideology about women was involved in constructing these first sex-segregated bathrooms. But I'm struck by how there's sort of an implicit ideology and set of assumptions about men and male sexuality, and that there's sort of an implicit assumption of the predatory male sexuality, which I think you still see today in the controversy that has arisen around the bathroom issues.
Yeah, there are these common themes of, on the one hand, vulnerability, and then on the other hand, a kind of macho, predatory presentation that gets associated with boys. One thing that I find fascinating, I have a strong belief that the spaces that people spend time in also tell us a great deal, not only about who we are, but that they actually help to construct who we are. So something I think about is, were we to reconfigure our public restrooms, might there be some change in the attitude of people who use public restrooms?
Is there an example you're thinking of?
So if you go to New York City, the most famous example is at the Museum of Modern Art. In the restaurant there called The Modern, there is a multi-user gender-neutral restroom. So I was there recently, and everyone seemed to do just fine washing their hands at the same bank of sinks. And all of them had been in completely enclosed spaces when they were doing their private matters. And I have a feeling that if we experienced that more in our daily lives, we would have a different attitude about what men are about and about what women are about.
Because we would be vulnerable together in this shared space?
Because women and men would see that women and men can be together in a space that, by its nature, relates to the more vulnerable aspects of what it means to be human, and that men and women can behave perfectly well and as equals. And this vision that Amy points to and that comes up in my research of men as inherently predatory, as inherently threatening, would slowly but surely be diffused.
You know, if I could just jump in here, because I can see sort of a perfect corollary. I mean, what we're really talking about is how do we create the conditions for integration between men and women and a recognition of our common humanity where we can all sort of claim, I think, more aspects of the human potential. And I see that specifically, you know, in this Dutch sex education video. I'm actually not even sex education, it's love education. It's a teacher talking very frankly with these 11-year-olds about what does it mean to be in love. And the camera goes back and forth between the boys and the girls, and they all volunteer saying what it's about. Like, you know, you blush and you see the world through rose-colored glasses, and you're always thinking about the person. So you just see how these boys and girls, who we assume in America couldn't possibly tackle a topic like that without teasing each other or putting each other down, and yet they're having this common conversation about these uncomfortable but joyous feelings.
And, you know, listening to you both, I'm really taken by this idea that the spaces that we construct, both physical architectural spaces and social spaces, not only reflect what we think now, but help shape how we will think, how we will behave in the future. What does your research suggest might lie ahead of us?
So let me address that. As we are well aware, there has been this controversy in North Carolina. The states having now adopted a statute known as HB 2 to keep transgender people from using the bathroom that accords with their gender identity. And what happened is that the NCAA, the most important athletic organization for colleges, universities in the country, made a decision that because of the discrimination that goes on in North Carolina, they have now moved every championship tournament scheduled to take place over the coming academic year away from North Carolina. Mm. And in terms of sort of what Amy speaks of, it's like, how do young boys, young men, learn about important things like connection and caring and equality, symbolically having the most important athletic organization in the country say, we will draw a line in the sand, we will take a stand against discrimination, seems to me to be a major event.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree on that hopeful note in the sense that I think cultures can change, and I do see that there is more fluidity in the way we think about, or we're starting to have conversations about boys and their emotional needs and capacities, kind of like to maybe play a little bit of catch up on some of the conversations that have been going on around women and their multifaceted roles. And I would also say that, interestingly, in this radio studio, as I was given a tour just now, I was shown a room that used to be a private women's bank. Mm. So it indicates how things that we now think are ridiculous to sex segregate were once completely normal. And that, you know, gives us some food for thought for the future. Will we one day look back on sex segregated bathrooms and think that's strange?
Amy Shalit is a sociologist at the University of Massachusetts Amherst and author of Not Under My Roof, a book about parents, teens, and the culture of sex. Terry Kogan is a law professor at the University of Utah. Our talk was prompted by articles they wrote for The Conversation, a daily digital publication of news and commentary from the academic and research community. Check it out online at theconversation.com. To the Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Wisconsin Public Radio in Madison. Our producers are Doug Gordon, Charles Monroe Kane, and Raymond Tungekar. Steve Mullen from Walk West Music wrote our theme. Kirill Owen is our technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer. And I'm Ann Strainchamps. Thanks for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.